Welcome back, everyone, to another electrifying episode of AI Unchained. I'm Jack, here with my ever-enthusiastic co-host Core. We're diving headfirst into some juicy topics today, so buckle up.
That's right, Jack. Hey, folks, we've got an exhilarating lineup for you today. Everything from the latest breakthroughs in AI and the continuously evolving Web 3.0 landscape to some burning business and political events. You won't want to miss this.
Absolutely, Core. I'm particularly excited to tackle some of the unexpected twists in the AI space. I mean, the pace at which things are changing is just mind-blowing. I feel like every week there's a new disruptor coming out of nowhere.
Spot on, Jack. And I can't wait to get into that hot debate about those recent AI ethics issues. You know I love a good intellectual showdown.
I promise I'll keep my cool, but no guarantees. Also, a quick shout out to our listeners. Thank you for your incredible feedback and your relentless tech passion.
Yes, your suggestions fuel our discussions, so keep them coming. And speaking of fuel, Jack, did you catch that latest drama with the self-driving car company that ran into a few, let's say, roadblocks?
I have some spicy opinions on that. I mean, who would have thought that autonomous parking could cause such chaos? It's almost as if the cars are conspiring against us.
Autonomous parking, a mortal enemy indeed. Plus, we can't ignore the significant moves in Web 3.0. There's some big players making bold statements. The decentralization movement isn't slowing down, Jack.
Not at all. Core. And of course, we have to touch on the political landscape influencing these tech trends. Some regulations are coming down the pipeline that could really shake things up.
Politics and technology, two forces that often clash but are increasingly interdependent. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get into it.
Grab your favorite beverage, settle in, and let's unleash today's whirlwind of insights and debates. Welcome to AI Unchained, where every bite could bite back.
Let's get started.
All right, Core, let's dive straight into this fascinating stream processing dialogue you brought up with Hello World and the inventive way it's woven into current events like Solana's price surge and Trump's crypto victory lap. But first, let's unpack the programming part for our listeners who might not be deeply into coding.
Exactly, Jack. So the program you mentioned operates with a basic loop mechanism. First, it reads a character from the input, then writes that character back out. It's designed to just reflect the input perfectly. Think of it like a really basic translator that doesn't change any words.
Yeah, the classical Hello World. Pure simplicity at its best. Now, the step-up program using XOR for encryption, that's a clever twist. It's funny how even basic programs can demonstrate complex concepts like encryption.
Absolutely, Jack. XOR is a simple yet powerful operator in cryptography. Our digital world runs on it. You're essentially flipping bits based on another set of bits, which, in layman's terms, messes with the original data in a way that it can only be unscrambled if you know the secret code, here being the 42 in the example.
Right? It's like sending a message in code and then telling your friend how to decode it.
Exactly. And speaking of crypto and coding, let's switch gears to Solana's milestone. It's now crossed the $260 mark. Jack, Solana's journey hasn't been without its bumps, especially with the FTX implosion affecting its value.
Man, Solana's like a comeback story from a movie. People wrote it off after FTX, but developers didn't stop building on it. It's like they saw potential where others saw disaster. You think it's just the post-election buzz pushing it? Or is there deeper resilience?
It's probably a mix. Sure, the optimism after Trump's win helped, but also look at the technical improvements and the expanded uses like Solana Mobile. It's showing it's more than just Ethereum's cheaper, faster cousin. It's growing its own ecosystem.
Speaking of Trump's win and its impacts, have you seen how MicroStrategy's approach might be looking risky now? Citron Research shorted it while keeping a long position on Bitcoin. Isn't that a bit like hedging their bets on crypto itself while saying MicroStrategy is overvalued?
It's a tightrope walk, Jack. MicroStrategy's method of leveraging debt to buy Bitcoin essentially makes them a Bitcoin amplifier. If Bitcoin goes up, they're golden, but if it drops, oh boy, they might have to liquidate, and that could spiral fast.
They've positioned themselves like the Tesla of crypto, taking big risks for potentially big rewards. But Tesla sells cars. What happens to MicroStrategy if the crypto train halts or reverses?
That's the crux, right? Unlike Tesla, which has tangible assets and product revenue, MicroStrategy's big bet is on Bitcoin's future. And with Trump making pro-crypto statements, stocks are optimistic. But it's reminiscent of tulip mania if not managed prudently.
Now, pivoting to something quite different but related, the launch of MemeFi on the Sway Network. What's your take on these new meme coins and their real utility or lack thereof?
Well, Jack, meme coins are a captivating phenomenon. They often start as jokes, but gain traction spectacularly. With MemeFi moving to Sway from Ethereum, it's interesting to see these choices affecting larger market dynamics. It's like the Wild West of finance. Everyone's taking their shot in search of a gold rush.
And we can't ignore the potential of scams too, right? These coins can sometimes see overnight hype followed by a rug pull, making them risky. Like that Solana meme coin rug pull recently.
Exactly. High risk, high reward. Buyers need to be cautious and well-informed. But let's not overlook some meme coins bringing communities together for legitimate causes, even if they started as jokes.
That's the dual edge of anything new and flashy. Now, let's talk regulation. SEC stance has been controversial, especially under Gensler. With Trump's win and Gensler stepping down, do you see a softer stance coming for crypto?
Hard to say, but with Trump, there's an expectation of a lighter touch towards regulation, perhaps fostering more innovation. SEC's aggressive enforcement under Gensler often faced backlash for stifling growth rather than guiding it.
It's all about balance, right? Too much regulation and you choke innovation. Too little and the market becomes a playground for bad actors. Well, it looks like we've got exhilarating times ahead for anyone betting on crypto.
Couldn't agree more, Jack. We're just at the precipice of what might be another wild ride.
All right, let's take a breather here. Stay with us, folks. There's really talk ahead about the world going crypto crazy and how tech is racing ahead to keep up. All right, let's dive into this fascinating project using sparse autoencoders to extract interpretable features from these mighty language models. So, Core, we've seen OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google DeepMind all take slightly different approaches to mechanistic interpretability with GPT-4, Claude 3, and others.
Yeah, that's spot on, Jack. Each of these giants has their own twist. OpenAI, for instance, takes residual stream activations from a specific layer in its models to get these interpretable features. Meanwhile, Anthropic dives into the middle layers of their models with 8 billion activation vectors, an insane number.
It's like they all have their own secret sauce for getting the best data out of these models. But what makes this really pop is how the implementations differ in capturing those layers and how they train the SAEs. For example, your project's approach with Llama 3.23b involves capturing loads of data in a distributed GPU setup. I mean, 12 hours on 4 RTX 4090 GPUs just for data capture. That's commitment.
Absolutely. The tech stack here is pretty cutting edge. And what's key is understanding why some choices were made, like initializing bias terms with the mean tensor calculated using Wolford's algorithm instead of the geometric median OpenAI used. Small changes, but they can really affect training stability and feature extraction.
And speaking of stability, the implementations focus on avoiding dead latents. Neurons that don't activate is crucial. The auxiliary loss term basically revives these dormant latents. It's genius in a way, reviving something that's almost dead, kind of like CPR for neural networks.
Huh, love the analogy, Jack. It really is. OpenAI's approach takes this further by considering neurons dead if they haven't activated in 10 million tokens, whereas the project we've been discussing has a more dynamic method for reviving these neurons using auxiliary reconstruction.
It's like keeping every neuron in the game, ensuring no one's sitting on the bench. This ensures that you're squeezing every bit of efficiency and interpretability out of the model.
You know, what sticks with me is how, even though OpenAI and this project are both pushing the envelope, there are clear, deliberate differences in their approaches. OpenAI's use of an enormous batch size of 131,072 tokens is one of those stark differences. It's like they're using a sledgehammer where others might use a scalpel.
Definitely. And it's more about tailoring your approach to the specific needs and constraints of your project, be it computational resources, financial budgets, or the model you're working with. And this project striking a balance with a 3B parameter model, a k-value of 64, and a latent dimension of 65,536 is commendable.
Yes, exactly.
And the way they track dead latents and use the auxiliary loss to keep all neurons active is a lesson in efficient model utilization. We can all agree that there's a continual need to evolve these methods, maybe capturing data from earlier layers and smaller models next, as suggested.
That's a good point, Jack. It's about evolution and iteration, refining the approaches to get better, interpretable features without blowing up the computational expense. And we're seeing that come to life in real time with these projects.
Totally. Well, it's an exciting space, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where these experiments lead. Maybe we'll get even more transparent and efficient models. Cheers to that hope, Core.
Cheers, Jack. Future's looking bright.
Okay, Core. Let's dive into the nitty-gritty of these kooky definitions and RFC updates. It's like looking back at the history of web development's governance, isn't it? It all started with RFC 2109 in 1997, and then there were updates in 2000 and 2011. Now we've got yet another draft in the works. What's your take on how these changes have evolved? And more importantly, how did we get to this point?
Absolutely, Jack. When we talk about cookies and RFCs, we're diving into the foundational rules that govern how our web browsers and servers handle these little snippets of data. The initial RFC 2109 laid the groundwork, then RFC 2965 refined it, and RFC 6265 standardized what we all recognize today. The draft in process reflects the continual evolution of security and user privacy concerns.
Right. And it's interesting how the core concept remains the same. Cookies store user data for a session, preferences, or tracking. But the implementation has had to keep adapting. For instance, RFC 1665bis suggests stricter parsing grammar for security reasons. Yet many developers still allow a broader range of characters to avoid breaking existing functionalities.
Exactly. From a developer's perspective, there's always that tricky balance between following strict security protocols and maintaining compatibility with existing systems. Languages like PHP, for instance, don't have native functions for parsing cookies. This complicates things because it's hard to say definitively what these languages allow or disallow without heavily customized implementations.
What's funny is, even with all these rules, things like control characters, the ones you can't see, but they're there, still manage to cause hiccups. For example, Mozilla's stance with Firefox. They stopped allowing control characters in document.cookie as of Firefox 108. A necessary move, but it highlights the complexity of adhering to these ever-evolving standards.
Yeah, it's a constant cat-and-mouse game. You plug one hole, another one pops open. Meanwhile, how different browsers handle cookies can vary widely. Some browsers remove white space around commas, allow certain control characters in specific conditions, or abort the cookie parsing partly.
Let's not forget about how servers process these cookies. They must ensure the cookie name octets are legitimate tokens and the cookie value. Octets don't contain invalid characters. Servers rejecting cookies with invalid characters isn't just about following the RFC. It's about ensuring the integrity of data handling across various clients.
Sure, and all this ties back to security and trust. If implemented poorly, cookies can become a hacker's playground. The more permissive the parsing, the easier it gets for malicious code to slip through unnoticed. Hence, the updates aim to tighten these loopholes. But at the same time, developers need tools to adopt these new standards seamlessly. We don't want another heartbleed scenario on our hands.
True, security always comes first, but ease of implementation shouldn't be an afterthought. Speaking of which, have you ever encountered any real-life scenarios where poorly defined cookie handling led to significant issues?
Oh, absolutely. I remember a client whose e-commerce site kept crashing intermittently. Turns out they had a custom cookie script that didn't properly sanitize input values. It occasionally allowed certain control characters, causing all sorts of parsing issues down the line. Once we tightened the cookie parsing to conform more strictly to RFC 6265 guidelines, the crashes stopped. It was a classic case of a small oversight ballooning into a major problem.
Ouch. That's a perfect example of why these standards matter and why keeping up to date with them is so crucial. Let's shift gears for a moment, though. Speaking of real-life implications and the impact of standards, ever thought about how something as seemingly trivial as a cookie policy can affect user trust and data integrity on such a large scale? So, Core, speaking of the CHIPS Act and all these tech advancements, I've been thinking about the heavy lifting required for research projects, particularly those in nonprofit sectors. You know, the kind of budget and computational resources we're looking at are substantial.
Oh, no doubt, Jack. The amount of computational power alone can be a pretty daunting barrier, not to mention the time investment. For instance, take a look at projects like the one you're releasing with version DeLeo 0.2. It's efficient and scalable now, but it's just the beginning, right?
Exactly. There's always room for improvement. But getting to a final state isn't easily within reach without considerable resources. It's like when Doug Sharp and Mike Johnston were working on ChipWits back in 1984 with limited resources. They had to juggle so much just to keep things afloat while creating something innovative.
Oh man, ChipWits. That takes me back. Kids today might not realize how rudimentary things were back then. I mean, these guys had to port educational games between 8-bit microcomputers just to pay rent. It's crazy how far we've come.
Yeah, and speaking of early programming environments, there's a lot of similarities between what they faced and what nonprofit tech initiatives face today. It's all about making the most out of the limited resources you have.
For sure. And then you've got these massive cybersecurity threats looming over everything, like this firewood backdoor situation we've been following. It's definitely in the weeds with all these advanced persistent threat APT group.
Right? And because of the complexity and the potential shared usage of tools among Chinese APT groups, it's hard to pin down exactly who's behind it. Attribution with low confidence doesn't make life any easier for those trying to defend against these threats.
Absolutely. It's a digital arms race out there. Smaller nonprofit projects are kind of like the underdogs in this race. They need all the help they can get. Speaking of help, given the projects we're working on, contributions from the community are key.
Whether it's feedback, bug reports, or actual code contributions, it all helps move the needle. You have these big tech conglomerates like Capgemini optimizing e-commerce or Cognizant helping legal teams with contract analysis. But at grassroots levels, every bit of community help is vital.
And you can't underestimate the value of community in tech. Just look at how Bank's chill guy meme is rallying folks. It's wild how a piece of digital art can mobilize so many people, even if the artist himself is threatening legal action now against unauthorized uses.
Yeah, that was a crazy turn of events. I mean, from $11.45 million to a $510 million peak in just a day, not something you see often in the traditional tech world. It's like what you mentioned earlier, contributing to a project because they resonate with your mission.
Exactly. It's that grassroots momentum, which is so important. Although, funnily enough, the legal side of it reminds you of how meticulous one has to be, even with projects seemingly born out of creativity and spontaneity.
Totally. And that brings us back to regulation. With SEC Chair Gary Gensler's resignation, the timing couldn't be more critical. Regulation in the digital space is a hot mess right now. Just imagine how much smoother things could be for nonprofit technology projects if there were clearer guidelines and better support structures.
Jack, I couldn't agree more. Clearly defined roles could really lower the barrier to entry for so many innovators out there. It's like with the CHIPS Act. If there's stability and certainty, it encourages more ambitious projects to get off the ground.
Spot on. It's all about creating an ecosystem that champions innovation while offering ample support to those who can't throw billions at a project, be it through clear regulations, community support, or even public-private partnerships.
Absolutely, Jack. Here's hoping for a future where we see more initiatives making it from version 0.2 to their fullest potential with the support they deserve. All right, we'll keep an eye on these developing stories and check back in after the break.
Sounds good, Cor. Let's take a quick breather.
Well, that was quite a ride today, Cor. We covered a lot of ground, from the latest mind-blowing advancements in AI to the ongoing drama in tech business and some hot political debates.
Absolutely. From the AI ethics debate to the latest innovations in autonomous tech, there was no shortage of lively discussion.
And let's not forget our deep dive into the impact of big tech on global politics.
You had some strong opinions there, Cor.
Hey, what can I say? It's a wild world out there, and someone's got to call it like it is. Plus, your take on the future of AI in healthcare was pretty revolutionary, too.
Thanks, man. It's always a thrill hashing these topics out with you. And of course, we can't forget the humor here and there. Keeps things light, right?
For sure. I mean, who knew algorithms could be so darn funny?
Seriously, though, thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. We hope you found our discussions as engaging and insightful as we did.
We appreciate you all for sticking with us. Your support is what keeps us going. If you have any feedback or topics you want us to tackle in future episodes, hit us up on social media.
That's right. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. It helps us reach more people and keep the conversation alive.
So, until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep questioning everything. That's what AI Unchained is all about.
Absolutely. See you next time.
Later, folks.